Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello, welcome. This is Carl Nordgren. Thanks so much for listening. You're listening to 97.9 The Hill, Exploring Your Creative Genius, the weekly radio show that believes that creativity is so important in our lives, in our professional lives, in our business lives, in our personal lives, in our community lives, so important that I refuse to define creativity for you. You need to come up with your own understanding. That's going to serve you best to develop your own comprehension, your own sense of what it means for you to be creative in your life, multidimensional understanding, a situationally intelligent understanding of what it means for you to be creative. I'm going to give you lots of different prompts. I'm going to give you lots of different ideas. Some of them are going to come from me. Some are going to come from guests. So again, that you can hear lots of perspectives, lots of ideas, and you can construct your own understanding of what it means to be creative. This show, I have no guests. It's me once again. It's a little bit of a follow-up from last week's show. It stands on its own, but let me tell you a word or two about last week's show, and then we'll lead into our content for today. Last week's show was about privilege. It was about that incredible human weakness that we all have. I've discovered that we all have this human weakness that we are blind to our privilege. I first started thinking about this when I came across a research project where it was observational. Researchers were watching to see if drivers would give the right-of-way in California, where pedestrians had the legal right-of-way in a crosswalk, and would drivers respect that? Would drivers give way to that? And after hundreds and hundreds of observations, they discovered, they determined that, and they categorized cars just in a binary fashion, luxury cars and less expensive cars. And what they saw was that, what they saw through all these hundreds and hundreds of observations is that people driving inexpensive vehicles, like my Honda that's out in the parking lot here at the radio station, my 2004 CRV Honda, folks driving cars like that stop roughly half the time, honor the right-of-way that the pedestrian has roughly half the time. I think it was specifically 48% of the time. The folks driving luxury vehicles respect and honor and give way to the right-of-way of pedestrians 8% of the time. And when I first read that, oh my gosh, it was so easy for me to just sit back and condemn those elite, privileged folks. Boy, that's them. That's not us. Well, then I decided to do some more study of research, and I found a range of research projects that says, no, it's not them that are captured by their privilege. It's us. We all get captured by our privilege. We all have blindness to our privilege. There's a number of research examples where a certain group of the research participants are assigned benefit, a superior job, a higher level job. Others are the lower level jobs, less opportunity. And just at random, right? The profile, the demographic profile of the people who are given the privilege is no different than the profile of the folks who don't have it. And time and time again, and so very, very quickly, folks who are granted that privilege at random develop a blindness to the fact that they have privilege. They're given a privileged position in a game, and when they win, they think it's because they were so good at playing the game, not that they were given this great privilege. So we have this blind spot in the human condition that prevents us from seeing our privilege. So I want to talk about how our ancestors had these wonderful political community imaginations to keep privilege and power under control, right? To keep it from damaging the community. The first example I'll give you, and there's examples from all around the world of this, is when there's this important seasonal protein, right? Picture the Pacific Northwest and the salmon are running, and those salmon run for just a short period of time, and you need to be highly effective at harvesting that salmon because the rest of the year is going to depend upon it. or nut harvests, where the nut crop becomes ripe at the same time, and we have to be incredibly effective and efficient at gathering the nuts and processing those, because it's going to carry that, going to be our main protein source till the next year. Well, there's lots of examples of communities doing something like the following. This is my language, not theirs. They'll identify a big boss during, let's say, the salmon run. They'll identify a big boss, and that big boss has a police force. And it's their job collectively between the big boss and the police force to make sure that everyone has a job, that everyone's doing their job as effectively and efficiently as they possibly can, because our lives, our collective lives, depend upon it. So that authority is exercised for the health, the well-being of the community. But now the salmon run is over, and the big boss loses his authority. The police force loses their authority, and they return to civilian status. They return to their, you know, to their regular way of life. Well, isn't it pretty clear, folks, that it makes it much less likely that that big boss will abuse his authority, that the police force will take advantage of their authority in those positions when they have that authority, because they know that they're not only going to lose that authority, but they're going to go and live with the folks over whom they've exercised this authority. And it makes me quite optimistic to think that we were so smart to realize that, of course, that's going to moderate, mitigate our abuses of our authority, knowing that, number one, we're going to give it up, but that, number two, we have to live with the consequences of any abuse that we might have applied to somebody during the time where I was in authority. What a graceful way of making sure that these people in powerful positions don't abuse their power. There's lots of other examples of where Paleolithic and Neolithic, late Paleolithic and Neolithic communities get to a size, you know, it seems like around 200,000, a quarter of a million in that community, where a full-time police force, they determined, becomes necessary. Well, it's a full-time police force, but it's part-time policemen. There's so many instances where the individuals, the police within that police force, are rotated in and out, right? It seems like 6 months is a usual rotation period. I'll be a policeman for 6 months, but then I lose that authority, and I once again return to my civilian life. And once again, doesn't it make you optimistic? Doesn't it make you think that we're going to be less likely to abuse our police authority, knowing we're going to give it up, and knowing we're going to go live with the people over whom we exercised this authority? We've got some more to say on the topic, folks. When you come on back from the break, I hope you will.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. This is Exploring Your Creative Genius. I'm your host, Carl Nordgren. This is the show that's going to give you lots of different perspectives on creativity. In this show, in the first segment of the show, we were talking about how our Neolithic ancestors made sure that when there was a dynamic in the community life that required some authority, a seasonal nut harvest where we needed a big boss to make sure that we were as efficient and effective as we possibly could be with that harvest, how when the harvest is over, the folks that have been put in positions of authority to make sure that we are as effective as we possibly can be, they lose that authority. They go back and live their civilian lives, and doesn't it seem very likely that it makes it much less likely that we would abuse our authority, knowing that we're not only going to be giving it up, but that we're going to be living with the folks over whom we've exercised our authority. Now, I'm not saying we mimic these specific ideas. I'm saying instead, come on, let's show how our imaginations, our political imaginations, our social imaginations can work to make sure that privilege and power in our society doesn't abuse. What I think of when I am talking about this, I think of a quote from Buckminster Fuller. What a interesting man he was, expert knowledge in so many different areas. And I'm going to paraphrase his quote, but and it's relevant, I think. And that is that when the ship goes down and the life vessels are life-saving vessels, the lifeboats are all gone, boy, human ingenuity will look around, and when we see a piano top floating by and it's buoyant enough to hold us, man, we'll use that as our emergency life raft. So that shows good qualities of human imagination. But Buckminster Fuller is concerned that too often we hold on to those piano tops, right? An idea that we grabbed hold of once upon a time because it was the only idea that we could find at that point in time. We're still trying to make that a good idea as our life goes on, as life changes, right? So I'm saying let's be really clear about which piano top we want to jettison and how we're going to come up with new strategies to make sure that folks in privileged positions have to acknowledge this blindness, have to be attentive to the blindness that their privilege very often causes. Another strategy, this is probably going to be kind of familiar to us. It was interesting to me how frequently in these cultures, in these times, communities didn't really have any problem with wealth accumulation, right? They didn't have much, you know, no real governor, no moderator on how much wealth an individual could accumulate. But they worked really hard time and time again around the world to keep that wealth accumulation from being translated into more power, more privilege. They were gonna work really hard. Go ahead, have your gold, but it's not gonna make you any more powerful than the rest of us. One of the examples that I was intrigued by comes from the late Neolithic Danube Valley, the Varna, V-A-R-N-A, the Varna culture. They found graves there that the archaeologists were just blown away by how much gold and silver and copper was collected inside these graves. They were abundant amounts of gold. But they saw all kinds of evidence that suggested that this wealth accumulation did not translate into additional power, into additional status. There were no fortified buildings, for instance. Folks lived in the same sized houses, for instance. No evidence that any house was any bigger than all the others. This is not unlike the potlatch cultures of the Northwest, where social status was not from accumulating wealth, but from giving it away, from sharing it. And so it was kept, in these cultures, power and privilege was kept under wraps, again, by these social sanctions. You have to act a certain way with your wealth. You have to be generous with your wealth. Spiritual harmony was a big part of the mitigation factor as well. What also was clear was how frequently leadership came not from any role, any formal role that anybody had, but leadership was so dynamic that it was attached to the most persuasive voice. On this particular topic, this particular individual has the best ideas about how to serve our community. In the next situation, a different person has the best ideas about what we should be doing about this particular situation. What this resulted in, and this is reported to us, this was captured by the early Jesuit missionaries going into the Eastern Woodlands area, talking to the first Americans, meeting the first Americans. And these Jesuits, this Jesuit tradition, of course, was to value argument, to value debate. They knew, they were trained at how to be good debaters, how to be good arguers. And when they learned the native languages, they were blown away by how articulate the people were. Every single one of them could explain, could debate, could inspire with their language. All of them could. And so that, again, came from this idea that I've got an idea here. I want people to embrace this good idea. I better be really, really good at sharing this idea. The Jesuits these Jesuit missionaries in the 1600s, 1700s, many of them were prolific writers, and they wrote books about their time with the indigenous people. They wrote pamphlets about their experiences with the indigenous people that were printed back in France mostly, and became extraordinarily popular. If you were a literate person, boy, you had these books, you had these pamphlets on your shelf, and these pamphlets were apparently consistently identifying two different taking two different directions. One was these Jesuits condemned all this freedom that they found, all this lack of authority that they found, all this individual rights that they found. They didn't like that from their Catholic position. They didn't like that at all, so they condemned the lack of authoritative hierarchy. But they, again, were blown away by how articulate the leaders were, and that leadership was situational. It's interesting, some folks start to relate some of these ideas that the Jesuits were condemning about about liberty, personal liberty, the pursuit of happiness, ideas that show up later in the Enlightenment. Boy, a lot of the early Enlightenment authors had these Eastern Woodlands tracts written by the Jesuits on their bookshelves. So coming back from the break, folks, we'll have some more for you.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. In our first two segments of Exploring Your Creative Genius, we were talking about what our ancestors, our Neolithic ancestors, did to control privilege, to make sure that people in power had guardrails, right? That there was no abuse that would happen from the accumulation of power and privilege, that we would always moderate that. And I loved some of the examples that they shared, that we learned. I'm going to use this last segment on a different topic. The topic is universal basic income. I have just submitted my newest book to my publisher, and in that book I talk about the inevitability, as I see it, of universal basic income. I don't predict when it's going to happen. I have no idea when it's going to happen. As you know from my work, if you know my work, the future is unpredictable. So I'm not saying I know when it's going to happen, but I think when the following is true, it is going to happen. When businesses are understanding how to use artificial intelligence and other technologies to add efficiency to their business, and that results in the loss of employment, I think that's going to happen. I think that's going to happen. It's happening, and I think that is going to businesses are going to be highly motivated to have this continue to happen, if for no other reason than 70% of operating costs of a typical business are employment costs, wages, salaries, benefits, 70% of their operating costs. So they have a strong, strong, strong motivation to try to reduce that, to try to reduce that. And here come technologies that are predicted by many to do a significant job of reducing the headcount and increasing operating profits. Well, I believe that this is going to continue. I believe once we really get into that understanding of how this can happen, more and more businesses are going to be doing more and more of it until finally there will come a time when the market's purchasing power has eroded, has seriously eroded, and there's no longer markets for these businesses' highly profitable products, their highly profitable services. And so when that occurs, it's going to be in businesses' self-interest and maybe even necessary to their business to be taxed, these high profits, these new growing high profits, to be taxed specifically for a universal basic income, to support a universal basic income. Now, I don't want that to happen in a fashion at a time where people can say, oh, that's just another welfare program, another example of government overreach. Universal basic income has already talked about that in that fashion already. So what if our political imaginations that we talked about in the first two segments. Here's the relationship, the connection between the three segments. What if our political imaginations resulted in leadership preceding the advent of universal basic income with a deep, deep commitment to creativity, to entrepreneurship, to building makerspaces, to build the other Commonwealth innovation facilities like incubators and wet labs, so and have that precede the advent of universal basic income, so that when it occurs, when that income occurs, when you get your monthly stipend, it's no longer a welfare handout. It's no longer government overreach, but instead it can be positioned as investing in these extraordinary folks that are just ready, man, just ready. Just let me have some freedom to do and build and make, and here comes, and you've helped develop these qualities of mine, and you've given me resources. You've created common wealth resources like makerspaces, and now comes the money. Was it Mao said, let's have 100 flowers bloom? How about we talk about 1 million flowers blooming? How about if we talk about a bottoms-up renaissance that will occur when our political leaders show appropriate, smart, creative political imaginations and precede, anticipate the inevitability. I believe it's inevitable. I can't, again, predict when it's going to happen, but I'm pretty sure it's going to happen. I'm pretty sure that there'll be a time where the Chamber of Commerce will say it's in the interest of their members, their business members, for the Chamber of Commerce to be lobbying for a universal basic income. I have found of all of my ideas that this is the most controversial with folks. I've had business clubs, social clubs that have wanted me to come in and deliver lunchtime talks. And when I indicate that this is a topic I will also cover, they ask me not to. They say, please don't. I didn't follow up. I didn't say why. You know, what is it that bothers you? But I think there's an inevitability. And imagine all aspects of our life that we design around our job, right? Our daily schedules are dictated by our jobs. Where we live can be dictated by our jobs, right? And so when this comes along, when we have this wonderful creative and entrepreneurial cohort of, or nation, and we're given a little bit of money on a monthly basis that we know is going to happen, and we're allowed to now go invest in making as makers and building as builders, again, I think there's going to be a grassroots renaissance. I'm going to be around to watch it. I hope you are too, and I hope you have a great week. Thanks for listening.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.